I'm Nick Baker, and for the next hour or so on the BBC World Service, me and Arnaldo Hernandez Diaz are in Cuba for Human Cubans.
We are telling human stories from today, Cuba, about life on the internet and about the freedom to be who you are.
If you're gay or transgender, that's LGBT Cuba later, and we're also meeting some very special Cuban American doctors. But at the moment, we're in one of the famously preserved American cars the country's so famous for. Arnaldo, as a Cuban journalist now living in the UK, when you come back every so often, what do you see changing?
There are more private businesses, more competition and better services, mainly private. New internet cafes, even a new email service on mobile phones.
But Cuba is still one of the least connected places on Earth.
The internet might help Cuba grow.
Chevrolet 1953.
Debe ser del año 1932.
1932 Ford pickup. He can name them as they pass, from behind as well. And our first human Cubans driving us to Santa Clara, he's called Yoel, and he's inherited this 1949 Buick 8, which is now his living.
He got a friend that he has a 1924 Cadillac, and he rents that car for weddings, birthday parties, and things like that.
Doesn't have a web page though. We're here to follow the signs of Cuba getting online. And yes, these old cars are a bit of a cliche. This one's running a Mitsubishi engine and Russian brakes.
This car was Joel's grandfather's back before the revolution.
On the business side, Arnaldo spotted you at Santa Clara bus station. You have to kind of hang around, choose the customer that you want. That's quite difficult. If there were a joelbuick8.com, a website that you could put up that says, Joel, I'll drive you around Santa Clara or out to the coast or wherever you want to go, you get it round the world, and you can do business with customers before they arrive in Cuba.
Sí, sería tremenda ventaja. Te conozco
el mundo. It would be a huge advantage of having a car like this to be online and to people will know you.
Es un poco difícil. En Cuba eso lograrlo es un poco difícil.
In Cuba that's very difficult. There's a minority of people with internet access, and even myself, I don't have an idea how to use it.
You've never been online?
Nunca.
Never in his life. ¿Y qué edad tienes? How old are you?
41 años.
41 years old, I've never been on the internet. You are a typical Cuban. A lot of people on the island, specifically outside Havana, have never seen the internet.
Music at the beach and in bars like this one in old Havana is everywhere. And much to your amusement, Arnaldo, I've been running up to bands and asked them for their website details and their email addresses, and well, they're just not plugged in at all, so no chance of viral worldwide fame for them. There's an economic aspect of Cuba not being online.
Of course, you can't get online, really. And the phone service and internet, everything is controlled by the government. It's provided by the government.
And the big one, of course, is politics and debate.
In comparison with Britain, of course, yes. You can debate on internet. You don't have the money to do that, but some people want the voice on internet. For example, Mercedes Garcia. She's an ex-army officer, and she refers to herself as a lesbian activist.
I don't have blogs, I don't have page, I don't have web, I don't have access. It's a very bad situation for me, because I need to have a voice to explain my point of view, to develop my activism.
But you're highly respected, you've got government connections. As far as your activism is concerned, you're a volunteer. It seems to me that you're a perfect candidate for an internet connection. And it's a matter of money, really, isn't it?
We must think about this and maybe ask the government about the possibility to have an internet, not only for me, maybe for my friends from the group of the activism. I said, maybe in my house, maybe in another activist house. No, not here.
She's been here since 7 o'clock in the morning, she said.
And what's she here to do?
¿Qué vas a hacer? She came here to have the service on her phone.
Oh my God, it's very difficult, okay?
So most Cubans, like these ones, queuing outside the Etexa office in Havana, that's the state telephone and internet service, Etexa, they just want this new email thing on their phones.
I have difficulty with my internet.
No, she got difficulty with her email on the phone.
Mobile phone?
Mobile phone.
That's really how most connected Cubans get email, on a state-provided service, on a mobile phone or at the cyber cafe. There's no shortage of enthusiasm for the mobile phone in Cuba.
The thing that they want is to keep in touch with friends and family, and sometimes people ask for medicines and where there is a supply of toilet paper.
But they're not using it to overthrow the government.
No.
And it's not only Cuban enthusiasm for the mobile phone, but American too, which is, or rather was, rather differently motivated. This is Yaviel talking about a now defunct service called Zuneo,
which in Cuban Spanish is the word for the ham of the hummingbird, a satellite Twitter.
He's talking to The World Tonight's Sarah Rainsford on BBC Radio 4 in April 2014.
Yaviel first heard about Zuneo from a friend. It was a social network based on text messages. Javier signed up and he began getting regular updates on his favourite topic, sport. He had no idea that the source of those text messages was a US government agency, USAID, one that's considered highly hostile by the Cuban authorities. Javier tells me that none of the messages he got were political. But documents seen by the AP news agency suggest that USAID aims to attract users like Javier with soft news and then use Zuneo to get political. Its goal, says the AP, was to spark an Arab-style Cuban spring via text messages.
So, according to the Associated Press, the American government wanted to carry on its Cold War with Cuba with the internet as the new battleground. USAID say they weren't breaking American law, they just wanted to help Cuba get freedom of speech. 40,000 Cubans bought into this secret service before the whole thing was detected. Clearly, the Americans, USAID, or possibly another more discreet government agency, imagined that Cubans light-headed with this Twitter-tinged taste of digital freedom of speech would immediately start to rebel. Meanwhile, the Cuban government says it does want to expand internet access, but it's not a big priority because of the economic situation.
It's really fast.
And Arnaldo is getting online in a state internet cafe.
I'm surprised how fast is it.
It's the Cuban government who has steered us towards this internet cafe, although we did try one in Santa Clara, 260 or 270 kilometres outside Havana, and that one was pretty slow. How much time have you got left online, Arnaldo? Because I'm getting itchy here.
36 minutes.
Of course, the other thing that we have to ask about internet access is how much it costs. How much does it cost, Arnaldo?
It's 120 Cuban pesos. This is the equivalent to half of the Cuban monthly minimum salary.
So that's a huge amount.
Yes, of course. Imagine that you are using half of your salary only to be 1 hour online.
One thing that surprised me, once you'd stopped hogging the terminal, was that at this cafe and the one outside Havana that we went to, you could get BBC Online, Miami Herald, and other sites that the Cuban government might feel a bit nervous about.
Cubans now can get international email accounts here, like Gmail or Yahoo, but they need to use the internet cafe. They won't have service at home. You need to be well connected, you need to be a member of the government, you need to be a journalist, you need to be wealthy in order to have that internet access.
And if the cyber cafe is expensive by Cuban standards, for a private business, running a website
would be unaffordable.
I'm wondering which is going to be the bigger deal, freedom of information or private enterprise, which is going on here in the Prado.
Well, Prado is a long street in Havana, goes straight to the waterfront.
And at the end of the Prado, you've got the housing market.
People there gather in order to sell or buy properties.
And at the end of this outdoor housing market, behind a storefront, HavanaCasas.com. Looks like an online estate agency, but DNL, who works there, puts me right.
To be online here in Cuba is too expensive for Cubans.
But these computers, they look...
They are not online.
But they've got all your properties on the hard drives.
Yes, it is in our database, and we have a network in the three computers we have.
And once a week, you go over to one of the hotels with Wi-Fi and update your website, and you can pick up emails on your phone.
Yes.
Is business good online?
Now that the government is a little bit open to new experience, yeah, I think it's good.
The housing market that I've experienced outside, which is people literally in a marketplace situation, buying and selling on the street, do you think it's a pity that that might be threatened by HavanaCasas.com and other estate agencies that are likely to grow up? Do you think that something will be lost?
No, it won't. It won't. There will always be Prado. Prado is a very unique place here in all Havana.
But it strikes me that when agents can get online, that will accelerate the market. And it feels to me like that is capitalism in action. And it's a bigger threat ideologically than the removing of the American blockade.
But if we go back to Marx and Engels, they said that socialism is the link between capitalism and a new society.
And interestingly, we're being approached by the police.
Yes. They saw the microphone, so they are worried I'm talking to the foreign press without authorization.
Cuban police neatly and politely making the point for us that everything here is closely controlled.
You also English?
And probably watched by the state.
Soy periodista inglés.
That's not to say that discussion, including online discussion, is discouraged. Far from it. Cubans can read and discuss blogs written in Cuba about Cubans for Cubans. And this one is Claudio.
Claudio is writing about his point of view, about his life. He doesn't think exactly how the Communist Party think.
He's kind of flirting with controversy without going too far.
That's the thing. If you are clever enough, you know where is the limit.
Un saludo bien explosivo para aquellos que siguen el blog.
He does one of the first Cuban podcasts.
My name is Claudio Belaez Sordo. I have a blog. His name is Tremendo Explote.
Tremendo Explote means explosion, big explosion. On the front page of your blog, the generation of change, you're referring to you and people like you, young Cubans in their early 20s, as the generation of change.
Sure,
that's how I think about my generation. Born in the 90s, immediately after the collapse of Soviet socialism, we've lived through a lot of change since then, change that have made Cuba what it is now. So that's what I mean by the generation of change. And we believe it's the ideas of this generation that have the potential to build a much better Cuba.
And there's some dangerous stuff in it, because you're referring to the Castro regime, as it were, Raúl and Fidel, almost in the past.
Yo no lo creo.
I don't think so. We are here as a result of what they gave us. In a way, we are trying to do what they did, change things. Not in the same way they did, that would be impossible. But I think it's good sometimes to see things from a new perspective, so we can continue with our version of the revolution.
One way or the other, the internet's coming to Cuba, or Cuba's coming to the internet.
I think both. It's inevitable. We hope we don't have to wait 20 years for this to happen.
I thought Claudio's blog was pretty daring by Cuban standards, but his day job is as a state journalist, and he knows exactly where to draw the line. But one of the conditions the Cubans insisted upon before giving us press accreditation was that while we're in Cuba, we didn't talk to openly dissident bloggers. Back in England, that's exactly what we did do. Now, this guy, Ivan Garcia, he's pretty outspoken. Here he is in his blog complaining about new rules making it difficult for family and friends travelling from abroad to bring things into Cuba. And that includes quite a lot of mobile phones and laptop computers. Apparently, there's going to be a clampdown at the airport. And he writes, we should be talking more often about the internal blockade the government imposes on its citizens. So what I want to know is,
hola, Iván, Arnaldo y Nick por aquí.
Is he scared of being shut down?
No, he's been an outspoken critic of the government since 1995, and he's been questioned by the Cuban intelligence services. But since 2003, he's been left alone.
I mean, is there anything that can't be talked about?
He says he has to be careful to stay within the law. It is illegal to insult the government or the armed forces. For example, he never uses the word dictatorship. He always says autocracy. He wants to portray the other side of Cuban society, to write about subjects the government media won't talk about. The government has tried to sell Cuba as the perfect society, but we have the same problems as any other Latin American country.
Does he think that the government is frightened of the internet?
Yes, he does. Every closed society is frightened of freedom of information. I think there will be more access, but it will always be controlled by the government.
And of course, unlike Claudio's blog, this one and lots of other Cuban dissident blogs have been translated into English.
He knows that Cuban won't read his blog, so he's more interested in international audience.
I also want to think about how Cuba might lose once it gets online. I asked DNL, the online estate agent, who really isn't online at all.
Of course, there will be people that will stay at home online all the time, but we as Cuban, we love going out. Out in the beach, under the sun, walking, talking, and enjoying. And I don't think that's going to be a problem with online.
Arguing, you forgot arguing.
Okay, I forgot arguing. Yeah, we love arguing.
Every weekend we've walked past this gaggle of men having a kind of argument about
baseball. Usually it's baseball. You know, they support their teams and they are very passionate about that. So the thing is to make the other guy really, really angry.
So this is kind of social networking, Cuban style. This is never going to be altered by technology.
I don't think so. It's part of our culture.
Cubano a Cubano.
Face to face.
All the same, I can't help thinking Cuba can't not get online.
I agree with this. I mean, Cuba have to say many, many things to the world, and we need to be connected to say our, en nuestra verdad, our truth, the truth about Cuba, with our voice.
That was Mercedes Garcia. At the beginning, we introduced Mercedes as a lesbian activist.
And I guess she's putting the L into the next bit of Human Cubans. Cuba LGBT. When we met Mercedes, you said, look, I'm not gay. Lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender.
I'm not gay, I'm lesbian.
But when it comes down to it, you've got all these definitions and categories people use to identify different sexual orientations. Really, I'm a woman who loves a woman. I'm much more than just a definition. So when I introduce myself, I say, I'm Mercedes.
That's who I am. Lesbian doesn't adequately describe me. I'm Mercedes and I love a woman. Love is what I'm talking about, and my right to love who I want to love. Gay, lesbian, trans, declassifications are all a bit limiting. I'm talking about the right to lead a happy life, not the right to be labeled correctly. That's worth fighting for.
All my life, toda mi vida.
Look, I was always a lesbian, but in 1992, I decided that I would live openly as a lesbian. Really, I was the same person I'd always been, but because I was living openly with a woman, I was perceived differently, a bit like a freak. It was complicated.
Anale, would she be seen as a freak today?
No, I don't think so. People are more used to see open relationship between people of the same sex. And since 1979, it's not a crime to be gay in Cuba. It's a different generation of Cuban as well.
Now, Francisco, journalist, now openly gay, for him, things weren't always so clear.
I met him at university. I didn't know that he was gay.
Basically, it was a long process. This goes back to university days. I remember my first gay experiences. They were very spontaneous and sporadic, casual encounters. And when I thought about them, I was very confused, conflicted. In fact, when I was getting ready to get married, I went to a specialist psychologist and asked her whether it was proper for me to have those feelings and still marry. And she asked me whether I wanted to get married, and I said yes, I was really in love. And she said, okay, go ahead, no problem, even though I told her about my gay experiences. I guess, just like a lot of people who get counseling, they're hoping for one particular answer. So I went ahead and got married, and it was good.
Looking back, was that the right advice, do you think?
It was the advice I wanted to hear. I wanted to marry. I could not imagine being in a homosexual relationship.
Why not?
I don't know.
I didn't feel comfortable with the idea. I believed in the idea of a heterosexual family with children. That's what I felt I needed. I don't discount the fact that that desire for a heterosexual family lifestyle also has to do with context, culture, social pressure. But back then, I wasn't aware of all that.
And we'll hear more of Francisco, more human Cubans, more Cuba LGBT, with me, Nick Baker.
And me, Arnaldo Hernandez Diaz, after the break, including the confusion experienced by a teenager with a very famous government connection.
The BBC World Service.
There's a podcast from the BBC that lets you take world leaders for coffee, top scientists to the gym, and film stars for a run. The World This Week, the podcast from the BBC World Service, packed with the global newsmakers from the past 7 days.
Climate action and economic growth are two sides of just one coin.
Patients can beat this disease, and we can beat this disease, but we have to stay vigilant.
I'm Emily Buchanan. Join me for the worldwide wrap-up of the week, not only what happened, but why it matters.
Western sanctions are having an impact here. The ruble is under pressure from falling oil prices, but also from those sanctions.
It started as a mission to punish Al-Qaeda and ended as a full-blown effort to build a nation in the face of a full-blown Taliban insurgency.
Download it now and every week at bbcworldservice.com/worldthisweek.
Coming up in Cuban Cubans with me, Nick Baker, and Arnaldo Hernandez Diaz, how difficult things could be here in the past.
I spent 4 years in prison for being homosexual. Unfortunately, this country didn't accept homosexuality.
And more positive observations from the front line of emergency medicine.
In the 7 years that I've been in Cuba studying medicine, I've never seen a drug overdose, and I've never seen any gunshot wounds.
Cuban Cubans,
after the news.
BBC News.
The United States has told Iran it's time to consider extending Monday's deadline for a deal on Tehran's nuclear program. Officials say the Secretary of State, John Kerry, made the proposal to Iran's Foreign Minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, during negotiations in Vienna. Earlier, Iranian sources suggested that a partial political agreement was close. The US denied there was any such deal. The family of the Iranian-British woman Gonche Ghavami, who was jailed for trying to watch a men's volleyball match in Tehran, says she's been released on bail. She was arrested in June during a protest outside a stadium where the national volleyball team was about to play. A suicide bomber has blown himself up at a volleyball match in eastern Afghanistan, killing at least 45 spectators. The bombing came hours after Parliament approved security agreements, allowing international forces to remain in Afghanistan beyond the end of the year. The Kenyan Deputy President William Ruto says security forces have pursued al-Shabaab militants to a camp inside Somalia after their deadly attack on a bus in northeast Kenya. He said more than 100 militants had been killed in two operations. Al-Shabaab denied there had been any military response from Kenya. Police in the US city of Cleveland have shot and killed a 12-year-old boy in a playground who'd been waving around what turned out to be a fake gun. Police say an officer fired two shots at the boy, who did not obey an order to raise his hands. An Israeli policeman has been charged with manslaughter over the death of a Palestinian teenager during a demonstration. The officer is accused of deliberately switching his rubber bullets for a live round. The policeman denies this. The Norwegian prodigy Magnus Carlsen has held on to his title as world chess champion. He beat his Indian rival Vishwanathan Anand. BBC News.
We're in a shanty town now, not far from Santa Clara. For BBC World Service and Human Cubans, with me, Nick Baker.
And me, Arnaldo Hernandez Diaz.
And we have more stories about the experience of being lesbian, gay and transgender, LGBT, in Cuba. We're here to meet someone originally named José by his parents,
who in the past was never confused about his sexuality.
From the time I could reason, I knew my own instincts. I was always attracted to men, always. I can see how women are beautiful, but they don't attract me physically. I see the opposite sex as anachronistic. I felt like this since I was small. I had my first sexual experience when I was very young, and my dad beat me because he wanted to know who it was with. He didn't accept me as his son because I was gay, even though my best friends were gay too. And he accepted them. To my dying day, I will always be gay. It's no disgrace. Although there was a time when people saw me as the worst kind of person, I spent 4 years in prison for being homosexual, at a time when, unfortunately, this country didn't accept homosexuality. But I proved to Cuba that I am a worthwhile human being who loves the revolution.
Today, the Cuban society is more tolerant. Gay people have more acceptance, especially in Havana and Santa Clara. But Cuba is a mix of African culture and Latin culture. For that reason, it's very, very deep in our roots, the homophobic feelings.
And here's another quite significant person growing up confused about gay people.
Since I was a child, I was listening to many things about this issue, that it was immoral, that they could hurt me if I get closer to them. However, I met people who wanted to be homosexuals, but they were good people, and it was a contradiction with the bad things I had heard about them.
Mariela Castro and the parents she spoke of were from the ruling Castro family. Her uncle's Fidel, her father's president, and her mother was a respected feminist and politician. As director of CENESEX, the state body for sex education, their daughter Mariela has championed the cause of gay and transgender rights.
I talked a lot about this with my parents, and They told me that they were people who were suffering, that it was unfair, and there was a time when people still believed that they were sick people. Then around the 1970s, this started to change, and my mother used to tell me that they were people who were not being treated properly, and my father also told me that they were people suffering because of that.
And we have to be frank about it. At that time, before homosexuality was decriminalized, Cuba, like a lot of countries around the world, treated gay men and women as criminals and put them in prison, and in Cuba's case, put them in labor camps.
This was between 1963 and 1965, and it was kind of a military service, and people were there to support agrarian production. Actually, this was some sort of punishment. They were there to work in the fields, in the agriculture, not only for homosexuals, but there were heterosexual people there also. My mom, she played an important role in introducing sexual education in schools, in overcoming the prejudice, and starting the change of attitudes. She tried to introduce into politics the protection and the respect for homosexuals. It will take much more time. It is the same in other cases, like, for instance, racism and the discrimination of women. We need to be creative in order to transform history, centuries of exploitation, centuries of discrimination that need to be transformed.
There's something else which appears to be deep in the Cuban culture, and this is the idea of machismo.
Actually, this model of society is one of the hardest things to change, because all the cultures that came to Cuba were based on a patriarchal society. And it is really difficult to change that, and it requires a lot of time to change.
And is it right to say that after the law changed, it was still difficult to change those attitudes of machismo among Cuban men, including, worryingly, among the Cuban police force?
It's easier to change the institutions like the police force, and we are working with them, for instance, because those are regulations that they must follow. It's easier to change institutions than to change the minds of the people.
You were for a long time a TV journalist on crime shows.
And I used to work with the police very close. The police attitude is pretty anti-gay. The attitude is still the same. I don't say the whole force, but there's a lot of homophobic policemen still working there in the force. There's still a bit of harassment publicly.
Eventually, Fidel Castro actually apologized for Cuba's treatment of gay people. But even though the laws changed, attitudes need to change too. One institution that we haven't mentioned too much is family. We spoke earlier to Francisco, who had gay relationships and then went to a counsellor to ask if he should go into a conventional marriage. So what happened next, Arnold?
He got married. Eventually he explained everything to his wife, but it's complicated.
En marzo del 2003, me diagnostican como seropositivo.
In March 2003, I was diagnosed with AIDS. There was no choice but to be very clear, because there was always the possibility my wife was infected too. I didn't know exactly when I was infected. This was really terrible, because I had to involve the whole family in a strategy to deal with the problem.
And is she infected?
Fortunately not.
Hi. In comes Francisco's son, 14-year-old Javier. He obviously knows the whole story. Francisco has a good relationship with his son and his ex-wife. He's got a regular partner. His illness is stabilised. Very different from José out in the shantytown in Santa Clara.
Francisco had the support of the whole family.
Financially.
Which is very important. So for that reason, his life is easier. Jose has a good job, but he hasn't the support of family. And in Jose's case, it's complicated because Jose now prefers to be called Adela.
And identifying as transgender means that as a Cuban, Adela, christened Jose, has choices that many other transgender people around the world simply don't have.
Yo estoy propuesta para la operación.
I have been put on the list for surgery. I'm taking hormones to begin with. It's wonderful that people like me, who want to become women, can go ahead. Wonderful.
So, Adela will get the surgery she wants free of charge. We asked Mariela Castro, director of CENESEX, about the economics.
Actually, the highest budget of the revolution goes to the health sector. This is a principle of the revolution, and the Cuban people doesn't want to renounce to that right.
But Cuba does face economic challenges. Can Cuba afford to make this a priority?
These surgeries are not done because people just want to do it. This is a need they have. And we in Cuba, we will continue to defend the human right people have to receive health care for free.
Salud gratuita. Yes!
We're staying now with health and looking at a part of Cuba's famous medical training system. Meet some honorary Cubans.
Dr. Larvik Flores from the Bay Area.
Americans who have trained as a doctor here in Cuba, who are about to be sent back to America to practice medicine.
And the fees paid by these very special students?
Nothing. Everything is for free.
Dr. Tachira Tavares from the Bronx, New York.
I'm Tachira Tavares. From the Bronx, New York. My mom immigrated in the 80s from Puerto Rico. I'm first generation college graduate, also first generation in the United States. I did tuberculosis research when I was like 16 years old. While in college, I did my pre-medical sciences, but I was also active with the local Puerto Rican community. And I learned all about this international program that we're giving scholarships to Americans as well in Cuba.
Cuba trains more doctors than it needs, almost all of them from developing countries. So Venezuela trades oil for medical training.
But these Americans pay nothing. This medical training is a very human or very humane Cuban export. The selection process made sure they had the right scientific qualifications.
Dr. Joanna Mae Sowers from Rhinebeck, New York.
But also a particular kind of commitment. They have promised to spend at least 2 years back in the States working in poor communities.
My name is Joanna Mae Sowers. I started the ELAM, or the Escuela Latinoamericana de Medicina, or Latin American School of Medicine, in 2007. I will be the first doctor in my family. And I was studying life sciences, and I started traveling. I worked with the Nyanza Project in Tanzania, in Costa Rica, and I worked in Nicaragua. And I was also in New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina, and so I was also concerned about healthcare in the States, and that's pretty much what led me to studying medicine in Cuba.
I have a great story about how I met Joe, and this is just like exposure to Cuba. One weekend, we went out, you know, to just learn about Havana, and we went hitchhiking, and I'm from New York City, and I was just like, what are we doing? Why are we in the middle of the road trying to get a car? Like, the first thing I thought about Joe is like, this girl must be crazy. And it's actually a very normal thing here in Cuba to just go out and carpool towards the city.
So, wealthy America is accepting around $5 million worth of medical training from poor Cuba, a country it lobbies against politically and financially.
You know, you can't take politics out of any program in which we're talking about relations between the United States and Cuba.
Gail Walker from the American organization Pastors for Peace selects the candidates and has to find exactly the right students.
We think it's important that no matter what, that any candidate respect the country that they're coming to, the system that they live under. If they can't do that, that's fine. They're not a match for this program.
Cuba is this giant mystery for a lot of people in the United States. However, a lot of my family members knew about the quality of education in Cuba.
What do Puerto Ricans think of Cubans?
Well, there's a saying here, Cuba y Puerto Rico del mismo pájaro, las dos alas. From the same bird, the two wings. Cuba and Puerto Rico have such a connected history and past. There's love and respect between the two.
Tashira's first language was Spanish. She learned English at school in New York.
But Joe...
I thought I spoke Spanish until I came to Cuba. And once I had to study medicine in Spanish, it was just, it was a whole new experience in the classroom.
I mean, my family constantly makes fun of me. I've picked up a Cuban accent, and so my family in Puerto Rico are like, oh, Cuban girl.
It's really a process of immersion, and medicine is a whole new language. So whether you learn it in English, or you learn it in Spanish, or you learn it in French, you're learning a new language.
The students from the United States, we have lots of experiences in U.S. facilities. So a lot of us actually work every summer in clinics and in hospitals, and we have been exposed to the language.
And now many of us are quite competent that when we go back to the States and we work in different hospitals, they don't even realize that we study medicine in Spanish.
Or that they studied in Cuban hospitals.
When I started this program, I knew that in 6 years I would be 30 and I would be a doctor. It felt like a calling. It felt like something that I had to do. And I just, you know, you take one step at a time and time has flown by. I mean, it's just, I can't believe we're already graduating.
Hola.
Felicidades.
Gracias. Profe.
There's a lot of people in white coats queuing up to get into the theatre here where they will be handed their medical diplomas. There's Joe.
I had no idea how many graduates were graduating and that the majority are international students. So it's very impressive.
Thousands of doctors graduating here from all around the world. How many, Arnoldo?
4,253 from around the world. There's another reception this size in the afternoon. And that includes our 20 from USA, almost all trained for free.
I want to take you back to being 24 and arriving in Cuba for the first time.
Well, one of the things that Joe and I always talk about is it wasn't only an exposure to Cuba and Cubans, but it was an international school with 28 different countries.
I arrived alone at the airport. I didn't know exactly where to go. And they had buses awaiting students because there were students coming in from Ecuador. And these students came in by the busload, but it was by plane. I mean, they would fill a plane with students, and I think it was 500 Ecuadorian students that came that year. I just kind of blended in. Nobody really noticed the difference. Everybody's just, you know, with the energy and the emotion and the excitement. And I kind of had to, you know, raise my hand and remind them and remind the school, you know, I'm an American. I have to get to the other Americans. Where do I go?
Where are you from?
From Brazil. Suriname.
I'm from the BBC World Service.
Look at all the things we're gaining, all the, you know, amazing friendships that we've made and connections that we've made globally. Thank God for Facebook in that sense. We have friends from all around the world that we have to maintain contact with, and we're happy.
Where are you from?
Ecuador.
Ecuador.
Yes. I am from Mexico. Paraguay.
But America needs doctors too.
I think it was 2001. When I heard that the school was actually going to accept students from the U.S.
Catherine Hall Trujillo from the organization that runs the American side of this scheme, Pastors for Peace.
I had a clinic at that time in Sacramento, California, the only clinic of its kind in the United States. It was run by grassroots community-based women to give health care to themselves, but we could not afford a doctor. And most of the people who worked there were midwives, and many students volunteered. And when they left, they would say, when I finish medical school, I'm going to come back and I'm going to work here. But when they finished medical school, they all owed at least $300,000, and they needed to get a job that paid them a lot more money than we could afford to pay them so they could pay their loans back. And we realized that if we supported students from the United States, that we would have an army of doctors that could afford to work with poor people.
I didn't recognize you with your white coat on, Tashira.
Yeah, I'm super excited at seeing everybody with their white lab coats. It's a very emotional moment. 6 years and I'm a doctor. I received an education for free, something that nobody in my family has been able to do.
Nobody in your family, I guess, has been able to afford to do it.
No, absolutely not. $250,000, and that's just bare minimum. Here I'm receiving room and board, food, even a uniform, stethoscope, and books, and the education, and it's all free. It's an opportunity of a lifetime.
A as we go further into the theatre, and it's a real scrum because all the mums and dads are here as well, of course. The white coats increase. What's happened is that halfway through the national anthem, there's a power cut, the music goes off, and this enormous auditorium full of newly qualified doctors is pitched into darkness. A reminder of the fragile infrastructure in a poor country which famously offers free universal healthcare under tough conditions, dominated by the American blockade. Arnaldo, I could just hear you singing the national anthem there. Despite all the patriotism, is the Cuban healthcare system all it's claimed to be?
Tashira and Joe can say more about that because during their training, they did a lot of work on the ground in Cuba.
You know, sometimes there aren't specific medications that patients might need, but the outcomes have shown that healthcare promotion, prevention, and just the way the system is organized in itself, they've been able to do just as well as the U.S.
And they do it at very low cost.
But that access to very expensive imagery, like MRIs, for example, we don't have that. In certain hospitals, you'd have to go to a national institution. But we do just as well with, you know, certain ultrasound and CT scans, and also using the help of other doctors.
I would agree that they don't have some of the more expensive equipment. MRI is a good example where, at least in my area at home, you can find it in almost every health center, and sometimes it's abused. Once you have that equipment, you need to, at least in our system, pay for that equipment. Here in Cuba, they have a very good system of coordinating care. And so not every hospital needs an MRI. You can coordinate that care for them if it's needed. Sometimes they may not have, for example, the mesh that's used for hernia repairs. And that may be because of the U.S. economic embargo. But they develop techniques, you know.
All the same, are there some shortages which threaten life?
I haven't been exposed to any moment in which a patient couldn't receive care where their life was shortened because of the lack of any resource. I personally haven't had that experience here.
I was with the Cuban doctors in Haiti for 5 months, and that was, I don't know, sad and disheartening reality. We weren't even getting victims so much from the earthquake, but we were getting patients who had no access to health care. And we saw, you know, children die because they couldn't get the health care that they needed because of either the lack of resources or the lack of doctors.
A lot of speeches at the ceremony,
praising the world benefit of preventative universal health care.
Viva la revolución cubana! Hasta la victoria siempre!
Quoting Che Guevara saying the future is ours. Che Guevara's daughter is here. She too is a doctor, a pediatrician.
There will be some people listening to this who will be angry at the choice you've made. Because what they will see operating here is a brilliant bit of pro-Cuba propaganda. Why is this country spending its tax pesos educating American students and sending them back to treat American patients?
Well, I hope they're not angry with me. And I don't think that's the only reason. If there's politics involved, you know, there's always politics involved. But I think it's really creating an opportunity, not only for U.S. students. Remember, this program was started after Hurricane Mitch for international students from all over the world to go back to their country and practice medicine for the underserved. And it was actually our own governor from Mississippi, Benny Thompson, who came down, and he was asking Fidel to send him doctors. And Fidel knew, because of the situation between the relationship between the U.S. and Cuba, that he couldn't send them doctors. So he would start accepting students into the program. And so I'm happy to be here as a proud American, getting a wonderful quality education and becoming a doctor here in Cuba.
Had you gone through that 7 years in the very expensive American system, would you be different doctors?
I believe I'd definitely be a different doctor. I mean,
this program attracts a certain type of student that has more political and social awareness. Health is essential for any working society. And the type of student that comes here wants to use medicine as a form of social, almost social change.
I think everybody has their own individual experience. I mean, you can be in Cuba for 6 or 7 years and you can be a changed person during those 6 or 7 years. You can be in med school in the States and you can be a changed person. So I think you have your own individual experience. You have your own, you know, path in life. And this was mine. And I don't think, even if I had $500,000, I would have done it any other way.
You guys can go back, serve a couple of years doing community medicine, and then make money.
But I think most of the people coming into this program, that's not their aim. We do come out of the program debt-free, so we're free to choose to work, you know, where we please and to work with those underserved communities, and we're not looking to make big bucks per se.
You mean to be debt-free means to have the choice to work in the community?
I feel it does, and I know from friends they need to work very hard to pay back that debt, and so it's a driving force for where you're going to end up working and some of the communities that you're going to end up serving.
One of my intentions, I would love to go back to the Bronx and work within the Latino population because we need doctors that come from these communities and understand these communities. I'd also love to go into education. I'd love to encourage other women and other people of color to go into these scientific fields.
If I meet you in 10 years' time in New York, you won't be sitting behind an expensive Park Avenue desk.
Hopefully I will be sitting in a clinic in the Bronx and also in front of a classroom of medical students propagating the type of education that I've received here.
Congrats. Let me see that.
Oh my God.
This is Tashira's mum, Carmen, who traveled especially from the Bronx, New York, for the ceremony.
My dream is coming true. That's my baby, that's my daughter, that's my life. Have a daughter in the family. Thank you, Cuba! Thank you, Cuba.
Some people listening to this will go, wait a minute, he's ended a program called Human Cubans Talking to Americans. How much Cuban will you take home?
I think that a lot of Americans sometimes go around the world and they try to teach things to other countries. And I've really enjoyed going around the world and learning.
We spent almost a decade of our lives here. We've lived amongst the people. We served their communities, their culture, their passion. And it's definitely something that we treasure and that we will definitely take back with us.
Will you miss Cuba?
I'm sure we'll miss it.
The people that we've met, how can we forget that?
So that's Human Cubans with me, Nick Baker.
And me, Arnaldo Hernandez Diaz.
It was a testbed production
for the BBC World Service.